and welcome to the SAGE podcast of Critical Sociology's Labor Scholar Series. I'm Graham Cassano, Culture and Media Editor for Critical Sociology. Ruth Milkman is Professor of Sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center and Professor and Academic Director of the Joseph S. Murphy Institute for Worker Education and Labor Studies. Professor Milkman is the author of numerous works on the history and sociology of American labor. Professor Milkman and I spoke about her most recent research project on the Occupy movement. Why study the Occupy movement?
It has elevated the issue of social class to a central spot in the national conversation. So in that sense, it is about class. The slogan, "We are the 99%," and the focus on the very wealthy, on the elite, and their control of pretty much everything in the society and the political system included. You know, that is a class analysis that's been really revitalizing for democratic dialogue in this country. How long that will remain the case, it's already sort of fading, and not the movement so much, actually, which is faded from the media, but is still very much alive in my view. But the lack of media attention to it right now means that we're hearing echoes of that conversation, but it's sort of receding a little bit, and it would be unfortunate if that continued. So in a way, they replaced what labor used to be, that voice that would point to inequality and urge that politicians and elected officials address those kind of issues. And instead, it's come more from Occupy. And there's no contradiction between that. In fact, labor has very much embraced the Occupy movement around the country. It's just that as labor is so greatly weakened by all the things we were talking about earlier, there is a need for other voices to raise these issues. And Occupy sort of filled that vacuum. So the research has came about in a kind of strange way. Well, I'm based now here in New York after spending 21 years in California. I moved here in late 2008, just in time for the Great Recession. And along came Occupy right here in New York City, although of course it spread to the whole country very quickly. Sometime in the fall, when it was still occupation, when Zuccotti Park was occupied, I was in a conversation with some other people, and two of us had been at a conference a few years earlier about the 2006 immigrant rights marches that you may remember that swept the country, and the biggest single one was in LA, where I was at the time.
I do.
Anyway, there was an academic conference on the marches, analyzing them. What did they mean? You know, what was the... And one of the papers at that conference, which was actually done by some sociologists in Chicago, had reported on a survey they had conducted of the big march, or one of the big marches in Chicago at that time. So I sort of remembered that and thought, wouldn't it be interesting to do this, to use that methodology to study Occupy. So that's kind of how it started. And the way that methodology works, it was actually developed in Europe by a couple of Belgian social scientists. You basically divide up a march or rally or both, we did both in the end, into sort of geographic segments, distinct geographic segments, assign interviewers to each segment and instruct them to interview every 10th person or whatever number makes sense for your sample. And then you get more or less, you approximate a representative sample if you follow that method strictly. So it seemed like it would be really good to do that. There was a lot of sort of random speculation about who Occupy was made up of, who's supporting it, but we didn't really know. The only surveys that had been done, actually, I think this is still true apart from ours to date, were online surveys, which were self-selected groups. It was interesting, but it wasn't representative of anything. So anyway, I kind of got this bee in my bonnet that this would be cool to do, and persuaded my colleagues at the Murphy Institute, Stephanie Luce and Penny Lewis, to do this with me. And so we raised a little money to do such a survey and also to do in-depth interviews with core activists. And so we've been doing that since, we got the grant in late November, 2 days before the eviction of Zuccotti Park. The other thing we had hoped to do was to survey the park inhabitants themselves, but obviously we couldn't do that on 2 days' notice. So that we haven't really found a substitute for. But on May Day, this past May 1st, we did carry out the survey and we interviewed 725 people. And so we have some, we'll soon have some results from that. And we've interviewed about, I think it's about 25, and we hope to do about 25 more, you know, in depth. And it's one of those studies where, you know, the kind of combination of methods is really helpful, because on the one hand, we do want representative data, but it's the interviews that really get us a kind of new level of insight into the movement beyond what's obvious, you know. So there's nothing super surprising in the survey so far, but at least we can document who supports this movement here in New York anyway.
Tell me more about what you found.
On May 1st, so this was a pretty big march. You know, there's no like reliable estimate of how big, but somewhere between probably 15 and 20,000 people were in the streets. And we interviewed 725 of them, I think reasonably, with some confidence, it's reasonably representative. That's certainly not a perfect method. But that many people, this is not the core activists. These are people who support Occupy, not necessarily people who spend all their time there. Okay, right. So the core activists have a different profile. But on the other hand, it wasn't the most enormous march in the world. Like, these were people who all had some involvement in the movement and had supported it from the beginning. So most of them were pretty young. Well, that's not true. I mean, 42% were age 30 or less. Two-thirds of them had completed college, and that number was higher for the younger people. Or two-thirds of them were white, which is not the demography of New York City. Interestingly, more than half were male. The preliminary figure we have is 57%. That may change a little bit, but it is noticeable that there's more male support for this movement. And virtually none of them are Republicans. They are also fairly disillusioned with the Democratic Party. And some were all along, like long before Occupy came along. And others, you know, were big supporters of Obama, but have changed their view in the last 4 years. So we asked people in the survey if they had voted for Obama in 2008, which 84% of them had done so. Only 1% voted for McCain. The others voted for various third parties or fourth parties or whatever. And 70% of those 84%, that is 70% of the people who had voted for Obama 4 years ago, plan to vote for him again. And there's no big age differential there. But that means 30% don't, which is a pretty big difference. Also, about a fifth of our respondents had actively worked on the Obama campaign, not just voting or donating money, but phone banking, walking precincts, stuff like that. And less than half of them intend to do that this year. And among the young people who, as you'll remember, were the most enthusiastic of anybody about Obama last time around, only a quarter who worked for him in 2008 intend to do so now. So that's important in terms of understanding Occupy, because I think what it expresses, among other things, is a disillusion with mainstream politics. You know, there was a lot of enthusiasm, especially among the millennial generation, which by all accounts did constitute the sort of core of Occupy, the 20-something and early 30s generation. And that was the generation that embraced Obama most enthusiastically 4 years ago. And like many other supporters of Obama, they have become disillusioned by the kind of money and politics regime. And whether they may not like Obama that much anymore, that varies, but they do recognize the limitations of what's possible in Washington. And that's where Occupy came from, was out of frustration, I think, with that, along with the frustration of that millennial generation. And this is probably much more important than frustration with the Democratic Party. With the economic situation, because this is a group that's been hit extremely hard by the Great Recession. These are college-educated kids, mostly, who did everything they were supposed to do. They went to college, got their degrees, graduated, and then they face this labor market where they're lucky to get a job at Starbucks, and most of them have jobs that are way less well-paid and less relevant to the education that they had. So I mean, this is hard to prove in any sort of scientific way, but I'm convinced that that's a big driver of the whole thing. It's something we haven't really seen since the 1930s on this scale of a whole generation sort of disenfranchised economically, including the relatively privileged class of college-educated folks that Occupy is constituted of. So I think that's really huge. And so this is, and you know, by the way, getting back to the report that we did, and it's in all the other data on patterns of unionization, young people have among the lowest unionization of anybody. It's important to understand the reason for it. It's not necessarily that young people are anti-union, you know, some might be, but what determines whether you're in a union in the United States is not your view of unionism, unfortunately. It's not like you get to decide whether you're a union member. The question is, do you work in a workplace that at some point in the past has been unionized and remains so? So if you work as a school teacher, there's a good chance you're unionized. If you work for Walmart, there's no chance that you're unionized. And you might be the most fervent union supporter in the world and end up working at Walmart or Starbucks or some other non-union corporation, and you don't have a snowball's chance in hell of being a union member. And so the reason young people are so seldom unionized is that there are not very many of them in these unionized occupations. That's not where they're employed. And the same thing, by the way, is true of other groups. So if you look at the fact that immigrants, for example, have a slightly lower likelihood of being union members than U.S.-born workers, actually, there's a lot of evidence that immigrants are more pro-union than U.S.-born workers, but they're underrepresented in union membership because of the jobs that they work in, which are often in the informal sector or other non-union parts of the economy. So that's really key to understanding all the demographics. Union membership, it isn't really about individual preferences. It sort of reflects, you know, the unevenness of unionization through the labor market, and, you know, where you kind of land within that determines whether you're a union member, unless you're the exceptional case of someone who actually organizes a campaign to, you know, unionize your workplace, which occasionally happens. But that's tiny numbers in the big picture.
Did you look at the attitudes of the Occupy members toward labor and organized labor? And the reason I ask this is, of course, because labor did make, as you've already mentioned, some attempt to connect to the Occupy movement.
Yeah, we didn't actually ask about attitudes, but we did ask if they were union members, and about a third of them were.
Okay.
The marchers on May 1st here in New York, but that percentage was only about, was about half that level for the ones under age 30, for all the reasons we just discussed. That doesn't mean they were anti-union again. It just meant. Now, remember, that's like roughly the union density in New York City, so it's not anything unusual. They were kind of representative of the whole population that way, not particularly more. But there has been a strong alliance here in New York anyway between Occupy and the unions. Everybody was taken by surprise by the success of Occupy, including the labor movement. And some, especially certain unions, have really tried to connect to it, and it has had a big effect on their internal working. So this is just anecdotal, but we've heard all kinds of little reports of unions where new forms of internal democracy sort of blossomed as a result of all the Occupy discussions. And then other unions kind of, you know, didn't pay that much attention, but several of them got very connected, and they were present. They were very visibly present at those, at that march, and the earlier ones as well. And they were trying to get out in front of it and take credit for it more than, so, but getting back to what you said about the mid 90s, I mean, I think that was a really important moment. It was important in sociology too, because it sort of stimulated a whole new wave of serious research on the labor movement that's still coming forth. But 1995 is almost 20 years ago now.
Right. Yeah.
And the results have been quite modest in terms of the aims that Sweeney and his successors had to try to revitalize the labor movement. I mean, they did give it their best shot. I don't think we can fault them in any way. I'm sure they did made some mistakes as well, but there was a real effort to pour resources into new organizing, and yet union density has continued its relentless decline.
Right.
It did sort of level off briefly in the late 90s, actually, but that was as much because of the economic climate as Sweeney's efforts. In other words, that was a period of a sort of boom before 9/11 and everything, and the recession that started in the early 21st century. So, you know, I'm not saying it had no effect, but it has not succeeded by its own goals, which were to turn around the crisis of unionism and begin to grow the labor movement again. That has not really taken place. If anything, the opposite has occurred, despite, you know, a lot of imaginative, creative strategies and influx of young people into staffs of many unions and so on. You know, the kind of sort of downward trend has continued. And so that presents us with a whole new set of dilemmas. And, you know, it's a very bleak picture right now when you put that together with the attacks on the public sector. Occupy Wall Street really was a shot in the arm in that regard, both for labor and for the society as a whole, because I don't really see them as that separate, even though union membership is at such a low. It's a voice for certain points of view that remains really central in the culture. And, you know, now it really is in danger of extinction, I feel.
Thank you to Professor Ruth Milkman.
Thanks to Roz Hartigan for engineering and production.
This podcast series was made possible in part through a grant from Wayne State University. I'm Graham Cassano, culture and media editor for Critical Sociology. Critical Sociology is a quarterly journal published by Sage. For more information, please visit our website, crs.sagepub.com.